been our custom for many years to provide an opportunity for someone who's been on an extended retreat, residential retreat, to have a chance to report on their experience. There are several reasons for that, why that would be beneficial. First of all, a lot of what happens on a retreat is not particularly coherently integrated. Having the opportunity to think out loud with a receptive audience can be very helpful with that. It's one of the things I appreciate about making notes before I give my Dharma talks. The other benefit would be perhaps that people would be informed or hopefully inspired to participate in a residential retreat sometime. I have been participating in residential retreats since early 1982 and had been on, I can't even keep count of them, at least once a year. Sometimes a few years ago, I did four retreats in 1 year. I've been doing self retreats in this building for over 20 years at the end of the year. So I just completed one. It ended just before New Year's. So I want to talk about it, but my comments, please understand the context. I have been on so many retreats with many different teachers and a lot of self-retreats, and I've led a lot of retreats. So my description of my retreat experience just simply indicates where I am with my practice now and how I have been able to set up a system for retreat practice. Does not mean that that's the standard. My retreats here, my self-retreats, have a different kind of format than retreats that I participated in elsewhere. Although the last several retreats, I pretty much tried to recreate the format that I use for my self-retreats during that retreat with the added benefit of Dharma talks from the teacher. So that's a contextual kind of comment. So first I'm going to describe my routine, and then I'm going to talk about what really was of interest for me during the retreat. And hopefully there'll be time afterwards for you all to ask questions or make comments, perhaps from your own retreat experience. So typically I wake up at 5 in the morning when I did on this retreat. Usually they were 2 week retreats, but I've pared them back to 10 days this year. But in the other retreats, the previous retreats, I would come in and sit on this cushion for 2 hours and then have breakfast and go for a walk in the neighborhood and then come back and sit on their recliner in the front room there for 2 hours and repeat that back and forth till lunchtime, eat lunch, go for a walk, and then do that same routine until 10 o'clock at night. And then rinse and repeat, so to speak, sleep and repeat. So I did that during this retreat for the first 4 days. But my left thigh started really acting out on me. And I'm used to sitting with pain. I can sit very comfortably for, well, like I'll be sitting for 2 hours tonight. My knees might get a little stiff, but that's all. But accumulatively, over the period of a retreat, it puts a lot of stress on the legs. And so after the fourth day, I cut back to only 1 hour on the cushion and 1 hour in the recliner. I say only with a kind of a snarky tone of voice. Most people sit for 45 minutes on retreats, but I've been sitting for longer for many years. That shifted things for me significantly. It was very beneficial because I could kind of fall into the routine of shifting from one place to another. Somehow it was easier, and certainly my leg didn't bother me after that. I practiced mindfulness breathing meditation, basic Anapanasati, throughout the retreat, but that was my primary practice for the first several days. And it's my intention is organized around, well, my practice is organized around being intentional with the aiming and sustaining part of it. There's a particular craft or technique, vitakka vichara. Vitakka basically means bringing attention to a focal point. Vichara means sustaining that focal attention, particularly in this case throughout the in-breath, and then repeating the aiming, sustaining vitakka vichara for the out-breath. So I did that for several days, not so much in the intervals between sittings, to some extent, and to some extent while I was doing my after-meal walks. But what I did pay attention to during those intervals was not so much the breathing. The breathing was there. In fact, I've been doing the mindfulness breathing for so long that the breathing is often with me throughout any day. Not perpetually, but quite often, I'll just kind of realize, back to the breath, back to the breath. No matter what I'm doing. But I was trying to have an embodied awareness, not so much necessarily about the sensation or the process of breathing, but about the posture, the way my limbs were configured, standing or sitting or walking, to be aware of that sensational experience. But once again, I want to emphasize that it's not about the breath and the body. It's about the intention associated with the breath and the body. One of the things that's universal in terms of Buddhist psychology is every moment of consciousness is emerges from an intention. The intention can either be wholesome or unwholesome or just incidental. But intention basically is that how the various processes of the brain kind of coalesce into a moment of coherence and then dissipate, come together again, dissipate, come together again, very rapidly. So being tuned into the intention of a particular moment of experience is the primary practice point of this. It just so happens that the breath sensation is useful. It's with us all the time. And the sensation of breathing is neutral, particularly, typically in feeling tone. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Most of what grabs our attention has some degree of pleasantness or unpleasantness, the craving part. And the mind kind of builds itself around that, which is the clinging part. So with the sensation of breathing, because the feeling is neutral, it requires an intention to track the breath. So it's a training about intentionality. So that's what I was doing for the whole retreat, was cultivating intentionality, starting out, first of all, with mindfulness of breathing, then moving to what's called body scanning, body sweep, which I learned on several retreats with, under the teaching of Esen Goenka, who many people have gotten training from. It's a really powerful retreat experience, very challenging for many people, but I call it the boot camp of Vipassana retreat practice. But it's very powerful, very useful. I encourage anybody to go to a retreat in that tradition. If you want more information, just contact me. I'll point you in the right direction. So I started practicing body scanning fourth day. And the function of it, once again, is to build on the application of mindfulness and intention. The traditional training that Goenka provides basically says, drop paying attention to the breath. I don't do that. Breath becomes part of what's going on with the body scanning. It's systematically aiming and sustaining attention, one area of the body to the next area to the next area. I'll just give a descriptive. I've done this before, but I'll do it again as an example. My primary target for attention the last few years has been the sensations that are noticed in the inside of the upper mouth, the area above the teeth and the soft tissue inside the upper lip, and the volume of the lip, and whatever sensations might be noticeable around the rim of the nostrils. That's my target area. And I very intentionally kind of zoom in on that very persistently, but gently. It's not a forced effort. It's more like a settling into or an absorption into. Start with that. Then I systematically move my attention. I'll just give a brief descriptive. The upper lip, the lower lip, the palate at the roof of the mouth, the upper lip, lower lip, my face on both sides of my mouth, the cheeks, the jaw, up to the eye socket, the bridge of the nose. One of the fun things that I would do is when I would do the bridge of my nose, I would focus my attention on the very, very tiny tip of the nose to see if I could find a tiny little spot. I could identify a singular little spot right at the tip of my nose. That was kind of fun, part of the practice. And then systematically up over my forehead, my scalp. So I'm going to speak more, much more rapidly now. And not rapidly, but not going to spend so much time on the details. Move it through my head, my neck, across my left shoulder, my underarm, upper arm, down my arm to my hands, my fingers, each finger down to the fingertips, back up the arm, back up my head, down to the other arm, down to the fingertips, back up. So I would do this systematically, moving through my torso, my pelvis, my thighs, my calves, all the way down to the tips of my toes and back up again. So I would use this over and over and over again. This is a very intense kind of training that integrates what goes on in the body sensationally with what the mind does about it. And basically, the idea is that I want that scanning process to have more bandwidth, so to speak, in my consciousness than any kind of narrative, any kind of story. The story could still be there, not so much after several days of mindfulness of breathing practice, but I've said this before, it's like whatever my little commentary is in the other room with the door closed. It's very faint, not very demanding of attention or action. So I do that and I keep moving my attention around the body, just all inclusively, trying to cultivate what I call the zone, the vibrational zone of the body. The body becomes a field of vibration. So I would do this with just about every sitting for several days, and my attention would get very, very stable because eventually what was going on was a whole body kind of focused knowing of the whole body as a vibrational field, right? And then would include any sounds that were going on. I personally have experienced tinnitus for decades, ringing in my ears. It's very interesting. It's really useful meditation practice for me as well. But also any ambient sound out in the world would all be part of this vibrational field, and I would just hang out there. As this process progressed, the sensation of breathing was not so predominant. It was there, but it was part of the vibrational field. And it was more about knowing in the mind, breathing in, breathing out, than it was about the sensation of breathing in, breathing out. And the sensation of breathing became very soft and subtle. And the out-breath would extend out for very long periods of time before there was any awareness of an in-breath. So it got to be very quiet, very peaceful in the mind and in the body. So this is what my practice was. Now, what I was trying to do is to create a receptive flow of experience in order to contemplate the seven awakening factors. For those of you who are here in the room with me, I put them up on the board there in a particular configuration. Is to what I want to do now is to review what these factors are conceptually, and then talk about how I was actually contemplating their cooperation, their integration. First one is mindfulness. And it's this direct subjective knowledge regarding what comes to awareness. That's what mindfulness is. There's a contemporary psychological term called metacognition. There are two functions in the literature, described in the literature regarding metacognitive awareness. First is metacognitive knowledge. This is knowing what you're thinking as you're thinking. The example that I was found in the research is being aware that required more of a certain kind of attention when doing something technically than reading a novel. Right? So there's that consideration of being aware of what you're thinking. I recall what I was just saying about what was going on in that vibrational zone, that there was a kind of inclusive awareness of everything that was passing through consciousness. And that's that metacognitive awareness, metacognitive knowledge. Another aspect of metacognition in this psychology literature is knowing what your how you're planning and monitoring your process, your progress in that planning is occurring. Being aware of whether something you're a way you're trying to approach it, whatever it is working or not. The ability to make adjustments, modifications. I mean, the most simple way is thinking about walking. We're having to make all kinds of adjustments and modifications. Mindful walking invites us, allows us to cultivate a more in-depth, sensitive awareness of what it feels like to be inhabiting a body while you're moving across the ground. So that's what's in the current literature about metacognitive awareness, and it's synonymous with mindfulness. Now, in another context that's perhaps more important in terms of the awakening factors, mindfulness, the word in Pali is sati, which basically translated is not being absent-minded or not being forgetful. And ultimately, what it means is to not be absent-minded about the impermanent nature of our thought processes. Transitory nature of subjective experience, changing all the time. And to not to disidentify with the stories that come up. What I mean by that is the stories come up because that's what a brain does. It creates stories. But disidentifying with those stories as being, this is who I am, this is how the world is. That's insight into non-self. And mindfulness, not being absent-minded about recognizing how craving and clinging in all its manifestations creates distress and confusion. All right, so those are the three considerations: anicca, which is impermanence, dukkha, which is distress and confusion, and anatta, which is the absence of an enduring autonomous self. So it's one of my goals in the practice is to really try to be mindful of that. So that's mindfulness. Next awakening factor is investigation of mental phenomena. What that means is that there's a curiosity. I talk about aiming and sustaining, vitakka vichara, being fundamental to the practice of mindfulness breathing and to the body scanning. It's also a maturation of aiming and sustaining is investigation of mental phenomena as an awakening factor. So what that means in the context of mindfulness is that there's the ability to track in an ongoing way how the mind is creating itself. How is that happening? How is what's going on in the body being interpreted by the mind? What kinds of fixations are occurring in the mind? That's called attachment to view. The most fundamental attachment is that there is an enduring autonomous self. So investigation is trying to disassemble that attachment to view, to see through it. It doesn't mean that thoughts are wrong. What it means is that the understanding of what a thought is and its function is understood from a very different perspective. That it's something that happens, that a brain does. The brain creates a subjectivity. And subjectivity requires an objectivity. Can't be a subject without an object, right? So the mind, the brain does this, and we call this the self. So what we're trying to do is investigate how that happens. And investigate it in terms of those three characteristics: anicca, dukkha, anatta. Third awakening factor is energy. Now, the way it's described in the literature basically is persistence in the application of the awakening factors. But functionally, what it means is that it's the manifestation of right effort, its best potential. Right effort is part of the Eightfold Path, but basically what it means is the ability, and this goes to that metacognitive awareness of tracking, metacognitive regulation and control. It's to notice what's trending in awareness, what's forming, what kind of selfing process is happening, and make a discernment with investigation regarding whether this is wholesome or not. If it's unwholesome, disregard it. How do you disregard it? Let go, back to aiming and sustaining with the breath. But in order to be able to do that, it's important to be able to use aiming and sustaining as an investigative function to see that the mind's starting to go down the wrong path. Let it go, called renunciation. Alternatively, when the mind is relatively free from those kinds of disturbances, the hindrances essentially, then what we can be more what can be more useful is supporting an emerging wholesome mind state to its fulfillment. And that's really what the energy awakening factor is that there's a quality of attention that's relatively unhindered, undisturbed, and the flow of experience, there's a persistence in terms of that ability to stay on the right track, so to speak. So that's the energy factor. Now, I think those three factors are the drivers of awakening: mindfulness, investigation, and persistent right effort. Why is that? Because starting with mindfulness of breathing, then including renouncing the hindrances so that the mind is not caught up in desire or aversion, the mind is not dull, sluggish, or restless and overactive, and the mind is able to clearly perceive what's emerging and not be distracted or wobbly. So those factors, when they those three factors, when they are functioning well, they enable the emergence of the remaining factors. Joy. Now, in a lot of classic Buddhist literature, joy is piti is considered to be rapture. It's a kind of hyper excited and pleasurable quality of attention. It's usually associated with jhana practice. But in terms of the awakening factors, that's not what joy is about. Joy is a quality of buoyancy, of heightened interest, of curiosity. You know, investigation certainly involves curiosity, but there's a kind of a what's going to happen next attitude. That's what joy is. And it's accompanied by tranquility. But tranquility is, it's not dull. There's a flow of experience, but it is stable and not scattered. As I'm saying this, I'm remembering the famous quote from Ajahn Chah, a very well-respected Thai meditation master, talking with his students. He says this to the students: "Have you ever seen a still river?" "Yes, master, we have." "Have you ever seen a moving river?" "Yes, master, we have." "Have you ever seen a still moving river?" What in the world does that mean? When I say that, I'm remembering a story that one of my teachers described. She was on retreat in Burma on the Irrawaddy River in a retreat center. It was perched on a bluff, apparently, above the river. So you would look down on the river. And what her comment was, when you if you look at the river, it seems to be very placid, very still. There's no waves. It's just still surface until a boat comes along. And the boat is not driven by an engine. It's going downstream and it's moving at a pretty fast clip. That's what this quality of tranquility is about in the mind. But it's also very associated with, much associated with the next awakening factor, which is concentration, or in the context of the awakening factors, unification. So unification, concentration can either be exclusive, which is what jhana practice is about. The only thing that's in attention persistently in an ongoing way is one singular object. It's called a nimitta, or a sign, in the mind. It's that the attention is just fixated on that, not in a tense, tight way, in a way that kind of soaks into it. It's actually called absorption into that singular point, to the exclusion of everything else. Everything else about the world drops away except that object. And that is the doorway into jhana. That's exclusive. Vipassana and the awakening factors, it's inclusive. I mentioned that during my retreat experience, I would get into this vibratory body zone, and it would also include tinnitus, would include ambient sounds, and it would include any kind of whispers of thoughts, streams of thoughts that were in the other room with the door closed. All of that, but in a very non-reactive knowing of it. So that's what the a unification is. And basically, what that means is that all these other factors are humming right along, functioning very effectively, cooperatively. And what that brings with it is the, or includes, is the final awakening factor, equanimity or balance. In this context, balance means that there's not too much excitement, but the mind is not dull. That there's a stability of attention, not wobbly, but it's not rigid. It's not stuck. It's fluid, still moving river, right? There's actually a word for this that I love to say, tatramajatata. And when it's translated, one of the meanings that's useful is that which can be found in the middle. Not too excited, not too tranquil, not too invested or fixated, not too loosey-goosey. That's a quality, and that's very closely associated with unification and supported by joy and tranquility, all of it a manifestation of mindfulness, investigation, and energy in terms of persistent, right, effort. So, trying to summarize what my experience was. So, as I was doing this practice, one of the problems that I've had over the years of my retreats is that I try too hard. I really go in there, I'm a man on a mission, right? One of the things that was useful about shifting from 2 hour sits to 1 hour sits was it did not seem to be so pressured. And it was more of a flow experience. And another difficulty in terms of trying too hard is one of the major skill sets, competencies to be developed is the ability to notice and let go. Renunciation, to notice and let go, notice and let go. Without joy and tranquility, noticing and let go can easily become boredom or distractibility. Very important to monitor that. But that's a lot of what I was doing. So my intention was, it still is, to get into this zone. And in that process, breathing becomes very subtle, faint, and the out breath lasts a very long time. I mean, obviously, I don't have a timer set on it, but I just, the out breath, there's a letting go into this zone of vibration. So that's what I would do is I would breathe in and let go into this zone of inclusion, opening, opening, letting go, opening, letting go, opening. That's all I was doing. Now I could have a goal there, but it would be counterproductive. So it requires a lot of patience. And that's part of the energy awakening factor is that quality of persistence associated with joy, kind of a curiosity. What's going to happen now? What's going to happen now? What's going to happen now? And all of that's kind of coordinated in my mind. So I was sitting here where I'm sitting right now, as well as in the recliner, trying to be really clear about this factor, to know it as it was happening, to know this is mindfulness, to know that whatever was going on, the aiming and sustaining, the soaking into is investigation, and to know the ability to recognize whether the mind was caught up in attachment to view, a certain kind of energized expectation about what I'm going to make happen, and instead was just openly curious, just letting go, just letting go, just letting go. That was my practice. And being able to recognize the real peaceful tranquility is very peaceful, very quiet in the mind. When I say quiet, there was sound, there were sensations, but the mind was quiet, non-reactive, aware, and to some extent not attached. Just being curious, what's going to happen now? What's going to happen now? Except there wasn't that kind of repetitive phrasing that what's going to happen now? Okay, now what's going to happen now? It was sort of like this persistent letting go, which is the energy awakening factor and associated with joy and tranquility, and noticing when this was all really kind of coming together and when it was not coming together. But it's coming together, that's unification and balance. And then it would kind of fall apart. When I by fall apart, the mind would get kind of scrambled, or agitated, or out of balance somehow. To be mindful of it, perhaps be a mindful. Oh, okay, this is dukkha. This is craving and clinging. Isn't that interesting? Back to body scanning, back to the breath. So trying to use this mind-body process to become more and more clearly aware of how this selfing process operates. I was in previous retreats, I've been really interested in realizing impermanence, but with this retreat, it was more about emptiness, non-self. What, you know, this kind of, you know, the word emptiness is has a negative connotation. It could also be described as fullness. It's inclusive. Everything is there, but there's no need for it to be any different than what it is at that moment. So that was what my practice involved on the retreat. So now we have time available for people to ask questions about this or share your own experience of this kind of practice if you've had similar experiences on retreats. Christy?
Hi, I had a practical question or a technical question, I guess. And you were talking about the focus on the breath first and then the body scan 3 days later. And I know that that's from other people talking about it, that's what they do at the Goenka retreats. And I find that the breath awareness for me is particularly difficult to focus, but the body scan is not. So my question is, why do you and why did they do it that way? When they start with the breathing, focusing on the breath, and then move to the body scan. And the second part of the question is, does it mean I'm doing something wrong because I feel like it's the other way around for me?
So, I'll answer the second question first. You're not doing anything wrong. The sensation of breathing is kind of a core practice in all of Buddhism, mindfulness of breathing. I mentioned earlier why that's useful is because the sensation of breathing is neutral. Breathing is with us through all our days. So it's there. You tie a little string around your finger to remind yourself so you don't forget something. It's sort of like that. So it provides that foundational stabilizing point of reference. But as I said at the beginning, it's all about intention. So it might be at this particular point in your practice career that the ability to be intentionally aware of the sensation of breathing has more appeal, is more accessible, more workable. Might be that another time, the sensation of breathing might be. But I will say that with the practice of mindfulness of breathing, the breath can become very subtle when the mind is very concentrated. So you have to look closer. And that looking closer part empowers the body scanning. It empowers the investigation part. It's also important to recognize with the body scanning that without a lot of preparatory concentration, what you think is body scanning may not be all that beneficial, all that useful. But that would be something to talk about when you're actually practicing with somebody who's a trainer, so to speak. Just like, if you teach people how to play piano. And so you really want the student to not come to you and say, "Well, I'm having a hard time playing this particular passage," and then describe to you what they're doing. You want to sit there with them and watch them play the instrument, and then you can give them some training, right? So the same principle applies in terms of using breath awareness initially, and then using whatever capacity for introspective awareness that comes from that to enhance what you can discover with the body scanning. And once again, the body scanning, there's nothing particularly magical or mysterious about what happens in the body. That tingling sensation that can be noticed, it's going on in the body all the time anyway. You notice it when your hand goes to sleep, right? It's there everywhere in the body all the time. Now, it's not always going to be pleasant. This is something I didn't mention. Sometimes this vibratory feeling was very irritating, sort of like what happens when somebody runs the chalk across the blackboard and it makes that squealing sound. There's that kind of quality of reactivity. But the instruction is that's where you work. That's where you work. And once again, it's the idea is to cultivate introspective, intentional, investigative awareness. So it's good that you notice that there's a difference. So what you might want to do is do the body scanning for a while and go back there and look at the breath. See if you can notice more with the breath or if it's more rewarding when you pay attention to it. Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome. Other questions or comments?
Yeah.
Yes,
So
Satish.
you talked about intention, and also you mentioned that you're trying too hard. What is your intention? And then when you're trying hard, what are you trying hard for?
And as I said before, intention is a function in the brain that kind of brings together the various factors into a particular configuration, and action comes from that. The action may be physical, the action may be just cognitive. That's what an intention is. And it's considered to be a universal mind conditioner. You're in the room here, it's up there on the board, isn't it? Volition or intention? On the list of the mind conditioners. So That's what that's about. Now, in terms of,
I mean, what is it? Can you put what your intention is?
when I say that I was trying too hard,
Yeah.
I was attached to a particular outcome.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. What is your intention? I mean, I know you told me
My
that you thought.
intention matures, right?
Sure.
Over the years and over the course of a retreat. It starts out very basic. The intention to notice the physicality of breathing in and breathing out. But as the practice matures, it's more of the ability to notice the intentionality of every moment of self-organization and whether that intentionality is wholesome or unwholesome, or just simply a moment of being that's not pleasant or unpleasant.
Yeah, intention to me implies that you have some purpose, some goal. No, is that wrong?
There's a, when you say that, what comes to mind is a famous Zen saying, enlightenment, awakening happens through the gateless gate.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that the gateless gate, if you have a goal set up, a target, at some point that target is going to interfere with you reaching the goal. Another Zen thing is that one of the Enlightenment stories, a Zen master asked one of his students to signify awakening. And the student pointed at the moon. And the Zen master chopped off his finger. And the student was awakened. And pointing with the finger, that's trying too hard.
Okay.
Right? Another way to describe it is the thorn. Simile. Craving and clinging, dukkha, is like a thorn that's in your foot. You're trying to walk down the path. The concepts and practices of Buddhism represents another thorn. You use that second thorn to dig out the first thorn, then you throw both thorns away. So that's where the edge of the practice is learning how to discern when I'm trying too hard and soften and let go, but not let go so much that the mind becomes loose and sloppy and dull. That's the balance part that I was mentioning in terms of the awakening factors.
Now, gateless gate to me mean that you're already there,
Well,
right? You're
that's
already
one of the
there.
assumptions of
Yeah.
that approach to awakening. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Buddha nature, already there.
And we have to kind of get rid of all the what ignorance about that. That's not the case.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the fetters. We
Yeah.
have to dissolve the fetters. Other questions or comments?
I have a question, if I
Yes,
may.
David.
Apologies, I don't know how to raise the hand on the Zoom device.
Okay, it's working, and then we'll go to Steve.
Okay. Point number six, unification. You mentioned that concentration can either be exclusive or inclusive. With jhana, from my very limited understanding of it, it's a deeply absorbed state of meditative absorption. The inclusive sounded more like something mobile, as sounded almost like motion, the state of no mind. Am I completely off, or am I in the ballpark?
You're headed that way. The kind of experience that is inclusive basically means that there's a term, it's called choiceless awareness. And that's one of the qualities of attention that, we're trying to cultivate. So that awareness is very stable, concentration and balanced, and not attached to a particular outcome. So that's, I don't know if that's answering your question or not, David, but that's my thinking
It
of
does. Thank you.
it. Steve Perlman.
Hey, Peter. In your discussion of the metacognitive awareness of the awareness that there's a thought, does that do you also go as far as also being aware of just the feeling that you get with that thought?
Yes.
Let's say that it brings that there's some tension.
Yes. So that what you described initially was the metacognitive awareness of thinking. The second part of your question is the metacognitive self-regulation, which is really what right effort is. So metacognitive self-regulation is the ability to not only discern what's being formed in the mind, but also to be able to disengage attention away from it when it's deemed to be unwholesome, and to support the emergence and fulfillment of a particular self-state organization that's wholesome, that leads toward awakening.
Well, I suppose that if there's a thought and you are aware that there's, some tension, that maybe it shows up as that your jaw is clenched, or there's something, maybe your hands, there's something that you recognize about it, that I guess
Yes,
maybe that helps to let it go,
on a
to
physical
know
level,
that that
yes.
is.
On a physical level, yes. And on a cognitive level, there can also be a kind of mental tension, a preoccupation. It doesn't involve clenched jaw or clenched hands. It involves how the mind is preoccupied with a particular belief about how the world should be. So both of those
Yeah.
are involved. That's what nama rupa is. Rupa is what's going on sensationally, and nama is what the mind makes of it.
And
And
what we create.
that's another benefit from the body scanning practice, is it really invites attention to the what goes on in that intersection between sensations in the body and what the mind makes of it.
So what we create habitually, then.
Yes. John?
I think I was thinking out loud of how the mind works when you think or you talk, because you think in words. You talk with words, and the mind does what the mind does. And it's a natural process to try to distinguish this thought-making process to its own.
Well, we have that capacity, but we typically don't exercise it. We don't develop it. That's what ignorance is not tracking that.
I agree. It's habit patterns. It's, and that's what I think sitting does, is it keeps you aware of what, how quickly you can trick yourself into an opinion.
Provided that you are intentionally setting out to cultivate mindfulness, investigation, and right effort. Those are the three key factors right there. We could sit and just, I call it cruise control. Just sit there and zone out for a period of time and think that we're meditating. But no, it has to have that kind of diligence. In fact, that's another one of my favorite phrases. Adapi sati sampajanya. Adapi is diligence. Sati is mindfulness, and sati sampajanya is investigation or direct knowing of what's happening.
Well, that's all I'm saying is that the mind's process is that you're distinguishing, you are taking apart the mind's processing normally, and you are stilling it.
Yep.
That ability is what it's all about.
Yep. Yep. And stilling it doesn't necessarily mean that you squelch it. What it means is that it fades. That's another term I didn't mention that I was trying to be mindful of, is fading. It's synonymous with the word viraga, which I often talk about, which is dispassion. And the way I describe it is what happens when your printer runs out of ink. You know, whatever's printed on the page gets fainter and more indistinct. That's what happens with viraga, but also with fading, that what the mind creates becomes more ephemeral, less solid, in that regard. Okay, so Sean.
Okay, thank you. So my question is, how are you thinking about enlightenment? And is there an end goal, to this?
Well, I don't
Right.
like the word enlightenment. Enlightenment is a holdover from colonialism. When Europeans first went to that part of the world, it was called the Age of Enlightenment in Europe. And that was basically moving away from religious dogma towards scientific exploration and so forth and so on. So that was considered to be, you know, enlightenment. But the word is the term is more accurately described as awakening rather than enlightenment. But awakening basically is a kind of a progression. Every time I can disengage my mind from a distraction, from a hindrance, and go back to the clarity and the tranquility and presence of breath awareness, that's a moment of waking up from distress and confusion. And that progresses on to more and more subtle and profound levels of awakening. And the ultimate awakening is the experience of nirvana, the unconditioned. But as far as I'm concerned, what I'm interested in is the process of awakening. And that's where the gateless gate part comes into play. If I have a described goal, I'm going to awaken. Then that becomes sort of like, I'm going to go to Georgia, get on the car and drive up to Georgia. Like there's, you know, if you drive into Georgia, there's a big sign that says you're now in Georgia and the pavement changes. But basically, it doesn't really look any different than when you just left Florida. It's an arbitrary designation of the border between two states. Well, the same thing applies to the process of awakening. We can set this arbitrary goal about whatever. But the setting of the goal interferes with actually awakening. Does that help, Sean?
Yeah, thank you.
Can I say something about that?
Sure, Satish.
Enlightening and awakening to me means you're awakened or you see the light of like who you really are.
Well, or how the world really is.
No, who you are.
There is no who to be really
Or
are.
what you are, not who, but what you are.
There's no you. I mean,
Right,
that's
exactly.
one of the problems, right? Is
Yeah.
we have to use language, damn those nouns,
So,
right?
right.
And so once we can recognize that the mind is creating this version of a self, not only for me, but for you, you
Right,
know, you're
right.
the object of my attention right now. But that's a complete fabrication in the mind that there's an observer here and that which is observed out there. That's what's to be dissolved.
Right, and that's what awakening or
Yes.
enlightenment is, that there is no you.
That's the fading.
Right.
And renunciation turns into relinquishment. That's the way it operates. Renunciation basically means turning away from what the mind fabricates. Toward that which facilitates awakening, but eventually the opening to nirvana means a complete relinquishment of attachment, that there's a subject object process, that there's duality.
Yeah, but if there is turning away, then the question is, who is turning away?
Exactly. And see, that's the big mystery. As soon as you say who's turning away, there's a trap there. There's no who, there's no away, there's no turning. And yet, we live in a world that uses those terms very effectively. After this awakening, the Buddha spent quite a while trying to figure out, can I possibly explain this to anybody in a way that they can actually make use of? And obviously, he figured out a way to do it. We call it the Dharma. Done.
I just have one word, which is awareness, which is to me covers all of those other words that were used to describe how the mind works and how it uses language and words. And that if you're aware of this process, you can continually untrap yourself when you sit. You don't have to
Yep.
be home.
That's wisdom, that kind of awareness. So, Karen, you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, thank you, Peter. I wanted to ask about the body scanning. I know you mentioned, you started with the eyeballs and the nose and upper lip, and I mean, you went into a lot of detail. I mean, do you ever but it all seemed like an external body scan. Do you ever look at the back of your head and
Oh yeah.
okay.
Yeah, I mean I look into the middle of my chest.
Okay.
I look at the marrow of my bones, so to speak. So it's definitely a whole body vibe kind of experience. It's not, there's no need to determine. When I say I look at the marrow of my bones, I'm not visualizing the marrow of the bones. I'm allowing that curiosity to soak into that zone that I call my leg, right? Until it's just the whole area there is just a vibratory field. And that would include whatever's going on inside the leg, as well as what's going on in the skin.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
One last question.
Yes.
How did you feel after this, your meditation here, self-retreat?
I felt like it was one of my more successful retreats. That had more confirmation. I started contemplating the awakening factors on a 3-month retreat. I mean, seriously contemplating them. On a 3-month retreat in 2012. So I've been doing that practice for quite a while. And so the it's just a path. I guess I just like exploring that path.
Right. You said successful. I'd like to know what you call success. It's hard to word.
It felt like I really had a more clear experiential knowing about the integration of the awakening factors. I don't know how to describe it any other than that, other way than that. And I got sick afterwards. I was not able to sustain. I mean, not immediately afterwards, a week afterwards, I got sick, and I'm just now getting over it. This weird flu thing is going around. That kind of drained the continuity from that awareness. But after when the retreat ended, I was in the zone often every time. I still, it was, the retreat ended, I was still sitting twice a day, an hour each time. And I was able to work with that until I got sick. And I can still do that, but it's nowhere near as integrated or vivid. My mind just didn't have the energy.
Thank you.
All right, so that's it for tonight. April, who's going to be speaker next week?
It is I.
Oh, okay.
And it will be on right mindfulness. So you gave a really good like pre-right mindfulness talk.
Great.
Oh, yes.
All right. So it's our custom for us to sit together momentarily into the evening. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well and hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.